You remember 2008? We had a big problem because of too much debt. Well, Adam, look out the window. Since 2009, the debt everywhere has skyrocketed. The world has never seen anything like this accumulation of increase in debt. So the next bear market has to be the worst in my lifetime.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. As we approach the end of one of the most tumultuous years for the markets in decades, investors' minds are turning towards what to expect in 2023. Well, if you want to know where you're likely headed, it's often best to seek the counsel of a veteran expert who's seen and studied it all. Which is why I'm thrilled to welcome Jim Rogers to the program today. He's a legendary international investor, financial commentator, and author of several books, including the bestseller Hot Commodities. On his previous appearances on this program, Jim warned us of an approaching bear market. Well, we certainly got that in spades this year. We'll ask Jim if he expects it to continue in 2023 and whether he thinks a substantial recession may be in the cards. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the program to help us make sense of this highly uncertain moment in time, all the way from China.
I am actually in China today. I'm making a speech here, but I'm in Asia. Yes. And I just finished quarantine in China. Not fun.
I bet not.
But by the way, Adam, I do have to make one small request. Listen, I make plenty of mistakes. So it's a very nice introduction you made, but you should also say, and Jim is happy to acknowledge that he makes many mistakes.
Well, I appreciate that, Jim. And that's why folks are such huge fans of yours. It's not just your knowledge base, but it's just you're a straight shooter.
Well, Adam, if you want, we can talk about my first wife. That was a mistake. That was a huge mistake. Oh, my gosh. So I make many mistakes.
Do we need more than an hour then?
days. But okay. I will tell you, I did happen to run into her a little while back, and I am so glad I'm not married to her anymore. At the time, it seemed terrible, but oh my gosh, what a great mistake that was.
Well, I'm glad you can smile about it now. I certainly hope you weren't running into her with a car.
No. It was quite by chance. It doesn't matter, but it was another accident.
Okay. Well, look, we are talking here. This video is going to be airing during Thanksgiving week. And so just let me be one of the first to wish you a happy Thanksgiving from America, Jim, while you're there in China. And we're very grateful to have you take the time while you're there to come on this program. I got a lot of questions for you, as usual. But if you don't mind, I'll start with the general one I like to kick these discussions off with. Any answer you have is fine. What is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, the current assessment is, as you know, we had a big problem in 2008 or so, and then central banks and governments around the world started printing and spending and borrowing money like never in recorded history. So, Adam, if you give me a few trillion dollars, I'll show you a very good time. I mean, you know, the world economy has been flooded with money and spending since then. America has never gone so deeply in debt so fast as we have done in the last decade, more than a decade now, 13 years. So yes, we're all floating on a bit of artificial stimulation. It always comes to an end, no matter how much you pump into the economy. It seems to be coming to an end. Inflation is coming back, which leads to higher interest rate. And some people are starting to say, wait a minute, this is too much debt. This is absurd. Not everybody. I mean, the Japanese are still doing it. Yeah. But some people are starting to question how much more we can do. So I'm not sure if the world has come to an end yet. But I do know it's going to come to an end eventually in the form of another bear market. And you remember 2008? We had a big problem because of too much debt. Well, Adam, look out the window. Since 2009, the debt everywhere has skyrocketed. The world has never seen anything like this accumulation of increase in debt. So the next bear market has to be the worst in my lifetime. I mean, it's simple arithmetic. The debt has skyrocketed everywhere. It's going to lead to a problem someday, and maybe today is someday. Or maybe it's already in process.
All right. Well, I want to dig into that with you. And I think that's a good jumping off point into sort of the topic of monetary policy. As we head there, let me just ask you a general question, given your vast expertise, both in terms of your career, but also you're a student of history. When the debt gets out of control for a nation, it really only has two choices. Right. It has to let defaults clear all the bad debt, which is hugely painful in the immediate term, or what it usually has to do is destroy the currency by choosing the inflationary out from the debt pile. Do you have a sense or gut feel that it's going to be one way or the other, or is it a coin toss at this point?
Well, given that the people in the Federal Reserve are not very smart people, you know, they're academics and bureaucrats, they mainly want to keep their job. What they will do at the first sign of some good news, and it may already be here, they will start talking about and even acting on slowing down. It sounds like they're going to slow down for a while because they think things are better, and they may be, at least on paper. But eventually, Adam, they're going to print money till we run out of trees. Okay. That's what all they know. If there start to be a lot of bankruptcies or even a few bankruptcies, they will get phone calls from people saying, you must save us. This is a matter of Western civilization. You must save us. They will panic and they will print more money. I don't think in the history of the world, many central banks have said, too bad, guys, it's time for a lot of bankruptcies. Go down the tubes. That's not the way bureaucrats think. That's not the way academics think. And the end result will be not good for you and me, but it might temporarily save their jobs.
Okay. And I don't disagree with any of that. I doubt a few of our listeners will as well. It is interesting, though, because we are now living in a strange time in that arc where many of the central banks are, you know, they are tightening, they are hiking and tightening. I know what you just said. It's interesting, though, but Jerome Powell himself has said, hey, America, we're going to have to take the pain of what it's going to require to bring inflation down here. I'm going to put some words in your mouth and you can correct them any way you like. My sense is you're pretty skeptical of his level of commitment to that, that as soon as we start seeing the first real, stumblings of the economy under these higher interest rates, I'm going to guess you're going to think that the central planners are going to do an about face and they're going to go back to their stimulative easing ways. And it's just going to be, you know, more of what we've seen for the past 10 years.
Well, let's go back to the last time something like this happened, which was the 1970s. Inflation kept getting worse and worse, and the central bankers made it worse and worse. But then the president, who was Jimmy Carter at the time, said to Paul Volcker, who he was going to appoint as head of the Federal Reserve. Volcker was a bureaucrat, but Volcker understood the situation. And Carter said to Volcker, you do whatever you have to do, and I will support you. Mm-hmm. Now, Volcker didn't believe him at first, but Carter reassured him that he could do anything he had to do. And in the end, of course, Carter lost the election because Volcker did what he had to do. Volcker knew what had to happen. I mean, this will shock some people, but interest rates on treasury bills, short-term U.S. government treasury bills went to over 21%.
My God.
That's not a typo. 21% on treasury bills. Because Volcker tightened and tightened and tightened. And Carter said, okay. Carter said, okay. Well, it caused bad times, but it killed inflation. Carter lost the election, but it did kill inflation. I don't think that there's a politician in the land today who would do that or support that. And I'm not sure there are many bureaucrats. I don't see this guy we have now as another Paul Volcker. And again, you know, in Japan, the head of the central bank has said, I will print, his word, unlimited amounts of money. And he's doing it. And the Japanese politicians say, do it, do it, do it. I mean, unlimited. It's unbelievable how much money that guy prints. But he is not, certainly not a Paul Volcker. I don't think we have a Paul Volcker in the U.S. And eventually they will cave in.
All right. It sounds like, you know, if we're going to place our bets, we're going to place our bets on central banks, you know, reverting the stimulus and in the longer arc here, you know, we're inflating, we're taking the inflation route, the long-term inflation route, which obviously spells bad things for the purchasing power of our currency. We'll get in a bit, Jim, to ways in which people can try to protect themselves from that. I'm sure we're going to get into hard assets and precious metals, et cetera. But before we get there, interest rates are high, and if Powell's to be believed in the short term, at least, going higher from here. What are some of the things that you would expect to kind of break first from, you know, this higher cost of capital in this at least short term turning off of the both monetary and fiscal stimulus spigots?
Well, usually the most reactive are the things that react first to things like mortgages, because it hits a potential home buyer that day. He says, oh, gosh, look how much my monthly payments will go up if I have to take a mortgage, a floating rate mortgage. They're very hard. It's hard to get fixed rate mortgages these days. So they get hit first, but then it seeps through to everybody else. Bondholders start losing money and they start feeling some kind of pain. And eventually all of us, you know, eventually it's on the evening news. By the time it's the evening news, it's usually pretty much the end. But, you know, no, we all suffer. You said interest rates are high. Well, they're higher than they were a year ago. But I want to hearken back to 21% Treasury bills, which have happened and can happen again.
That is true, although it would be so destructive this time because, to your earlier point, Jim, the debt is so much higher. I can't pull the federal debt numbers from the 70s off the top of my head, but I know that back in 2008, going into 2008, it was something like $9 trillion. And it's now over $31 trillion. So we've had a 2.5 times increase in what is that, like 14 years? So I just can't imagine what 20% short-term treasury rates would do to this economy.
Well, Adam, you indirectly raise an interesting point. In the late 1970s, America as a nation was still a creditor nation. We had debts, but it was, on balance, we were still a creditor nation, which we remained until the mid-80s. So there are many different things now, as far as we are concerned, we being the United States, and our situation is much, much worse. And these guys in Washington are making it very much worse every day. Not every month, every day, they're making it worse.
Well, so we can get into this a little bit more in just a moment. Do you take a little bit of heart then in the short term that it seems that the Republicans have taken the House and therefore we're going to have a divided Congress, and in theory, the gridlock will mean fewer, you know, packages and programs are going to get passed in the next 2 years?
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple. Yes, of course, if the Congress cannot act, that's good news for most of us, because, you know, they don't usually do good things for anybody except themselves. No, that's certainly positive. But, you know, as I said, if there's good news on the horizon or starts happening, it's a signal to the central banks, hey, we can ease up. We don't have to be so bad for a while. And that makes many people in the markets more enthusiastic and more confident. And we have big rallies,
like we've just been having right now. And I do want to get into your market outlook in a moment. In the intro, I mentioned the last time you were on, You were predicting that we will eventually experience the worst bear market of our lifetimes. I want to readdress that with you to see if you still think that's true. Before we do, though, I want to talk more about just sort of your general macro outlook, because there's a lot of signs that the economy is really struggling right now, and not just in the U.S., globally. And I want to get your thoughts on recession, because I have heard in some of your recent interviews that you may believe that we are due for the largest recession of our lifetimes, or your lifetime here. So can we start with that? What's your outlook for economic growth going forward? Is it indeed that dire?
Well, first of all, I would remind you that we have periodically had recessions since the beginning of time all over the world.
They're supposed recession. To be a natural part of the economic cycle. We just try to really push them off if we can.
It always has been. I presume it always will be. But Janet Yellen said, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, said, no, we have figured it all out. Don't worry. We have it under control. Well, she's got degrees from a couple of fancy Ivy League schools. So if you believe her, then don't worry. Washington's sorted all this out now. I happen to know she's wrong. And I happen to know that we will have recessions again in the world. And the next one has to be very bad. But as I explained, 2008 was a nightmare for many of us, for many people. Since then, the debt has gone up by astonishing amounts. You cited some numbers before. I'll pick any numbers you want. They're terrifying. And it's continuing to get worse every day. So the next time we have a problem, I mean, Adam, it's just simple addition. Look out the window. The debt is skyrocketing everywhere. So the next problem has to be very, very bad. It'll be the worst in my lifetime. And I'm older than you, so it'll be the worst in your lifetime, too. I didn't say it'd be the worst in the world, the worst in history, or anything like that. I just said in my lifetime.
All right. So we'll talk in a moment about what people may be able to do to sort of prepare for that in advance. But let me ask you this, Jim. So I've had this discussion with several other experts on the program here, which is, you know, the business cycle and markets are supposed to follow a boom bust cycle, right? It's very much like nature and the seasons, right? You know, you have prosperous times, things get so good that people stretch, you get malinvestment, and then you need the bust cycle to clear that out and prepare things to start again, right? So in many ways, we should not fear the down cycle. We should embrace it as just a natural part of keeping our economy healthy. But man, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we seem to do everything possible these days to try to avoid one from happening. And you just gave some great, you know, citing of Janet Yellen as an example of that. And you know, the thinking is the more we push it off, it's like building up, you know, potential energy, right? The more we push it off when it eventually does happen, well, then it's far more destructive than it needed to be because we held it at bay for so long. So here's where I'm going with this, Jim. Let's say I make you or the universe of wealthy on viewers here all vote and they make you emperor. Are there any particular reforms?
Will they make me?
They make you emperor of America. Are there any particular reforms that you would love to see enacted that you've, you know, chewed on in your decades of investing to say, man, if we just did X better, we'd be in much better shape?
First, I would resign.
Okay. You know? Probably the smartest move.
Yes, I would resign. Well, I guess I would first abolish the Federal Reserve. Then I would resign, because somebody would shoot me when things really got bad. I would cut government spending with an axe, not with an axe, with a chainsaw, because the situation is dramatic. It is historic. And I would stop printing money. I would let the market decide what kind of interest rates the world needs. Now, we've had three central banks in American history, Adam, as you know. The first two disappeared. This one is probably going to disappear too eventually, because they keep making such horrible mistakes. So, but if I were doing it, I would get rid of the central bank. I'd let the market determine interest rates as it has in the past, and the world somehow survived. Yes, we had recessions, but we've had recessions since the beginning of time. in the Old Testament, they talked about 7 good years and 7 lean years. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I are not the first people to know that we have hard times sometimes in the world and in history. It's been going on for many decades, many centuries.
All right. I think you'd probably get a standing ovation from a number of the current viewers here, Jim, for, you know, shrinking government, abolishing the Fed, having markets set interest rates, and getting out of the money printing business. Would that these could go from your lips to the ears of our central bankers. But as you said earlier, I don't think we should hold our breath for that. I want to ask you 2 more things about recession, and then I want to ask you a question that's based upon where you're sitting right now out in Asia. I don't know how closely you look at the U.S. housing market and the U.S. jobs market. These tend to be late lagging data sets, but with interest rates as high as they are, as you mentioned earlier, mortgage rates have almost tripled since, you know, a little over a year ago. One of the things about housing is that it is much more widely owned than stocks are. You know, 90% of all financial assets are crammed into the wallets of the top 10%, but housing is owned by a lot more people. How bad do you think we could be due for a housing correction, both with a slowing economy and just with the math of mortgage rates moving this much? And the reason why I ask that is because, potentially that has a much more bigger effect on the negative wealth effect just because housing is owned by so many more people.
Well, I just want to go over you keep talking about high interest rates. Adam, these interest rates in the United States in 2022, by historic standards, are not high. They're higher than they were a year ago. But this is, look back at the history of America, the history of any country, but since we're Americans, these are not high interest rates. In American history, so they have the scope and the historic precedent to go much, much higher, which I suspect they will, for the reasons that we've discussed, and that will have a dramatic effect on housing. We have had a huge amount of home building in the last decade or so. I don't have the numbers at hand, but I know everybody has been building houses. Some would call that a bubble, but even if it's not a bubble, it has certainly been a boom. And when that comes to an end, you know, if your house goes down in price, it doesn't affect you too badly unless you have to sell or something. But then when your neighbor's houses start going down and your relative's houses start going down, then you really feel the pressure because you know, if I have to sell or whatever wealth I thought I had, I don't have anymore. And then people everywhere start talking about it because, you know, one of the things that many people talk about are property prices, house prices. And if they start going down, it's going to be high on their list of things to talk about, much higher than the football game. If everybody's house price is going down, everybody's going to talk about it and moan and complain, which leads to more pessimism.
Right, and tightening of consumer purse strings, which then depresses consumer spending, which then makes a recession potentially even worse. I appreciate the reminder, Jim, about the historic levels of interest rates. And you're right, I should say relatively high interest rates given where they've been, you know, in recent years. I think one thing that though is different is, even at the higher interest rates back in the 70s, like you're mentioning, the ratio of home prices to income were much more sane relative to where they are right now, given how distorted home prices have gotten. So the only reason why I mention that is because it makes the destructive impact of a rising interest rate even more in this type of environment, which you're nodding as we're saying this. All right. So the other question is just on jobs. I assume if you believe that we're going to have the worst recession in your lifetime, then you expect that the outlook for jobs, the jobs market, is probably not very good over the next 1 to 2 years. Is that accurate?
Well, again, just look at the numbers and what has happened throughout history. Yes, we've had lots. I mean, I think unemployment has been the lowest in a long time in the U.S. when we start having problems, it goes from the lowest, it usually goes much higher. You know, things, when they get overextended on the downside, they get overextended on the upside. That's the way the world works. That's the way history works. So, no, of course, I would expect unemployment to go higher and higher.
Okay. And the reason why I've sort of been walking through this string is if I can sort of wrap everything that you've said so far up, it's plan for bad times ahead for financial markets and thus your investment, plan for your house to go down in value, and plan for insecurity in your job going forward. And I'm not trying to super paint gloom and doom just for the sake of it, but we've got real people watching this program. And to have a venerated, you know, expert like you deliver a message like this, hopefully people, you know, take some time now to do a little bit of pre-planning so that if indeed what you expect to happen happens, that maybe they're a little bit less exposed to it because they took some preventative measures now.
Well, Adam, forget who I, anything, forget any, just read some history. I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just telling you how the world has always worked.
Yep.
This is the way the world has always worked, just as from the Old Testament, they had 7 good years and 7 bad years. I mean, this has been going on a long, long, long time. So don't listen to me. Just read some history, do your own research, and then you will get knowledgeable. And if you get knowledgeable, you will get worried because you will see this has happened many times before. And it's going to happen again, as it always has. And those who are prepared and knowledgeable will do well and survive. Some people came out of the 30s very rich. Not me. I didn't come out of the 30s very rich, but some people did. So if you're prepared, you'll do fine.
All right. Well, that's a great message. And I do, when we wrap things up, I want to end on your advice for that, for doing fine. But here's the question I wanted to ask based upon where you are now, which is out in Asia. This has been a very interesting year geopolitically, right? We've had a lot of trade relations get completely shuffled around here. The war in Ukraine has really, you know, changed the political map to a certain extent, geopolitical map from an alliances standpoint. One of the things that it did, and I'd love your comments on this, is when the U.S. sort of weaponized its financial system against Russia, and, you know, basically seized Russian assets and orchestrated the West's boycott of Russia. My understanding is that sent a signal to a lot of other geopolitical players that, oh my goodness, I might not be on the U.S.'s bad side today, but I might be at some point. And therefore, there are some things I want to do today or start or now to start making sure that if that ever happens, I'm not as vulnerable to it as I am today. So, you know, some countries are de-dollarizing certain amounts of their trade. There's talk of an Eastern trading bloc really congealing over this. What are you seeing from your vantage point in Asia?
Well, first of all, the world has had many reserve currencies, international mediums of exchange in history. None of them have survived. None of them have lasted more than 100, 150 years or so. I'm delighted that the US dollar has been on top for many decades, but history would indicate that it's going to come to an end and that maybe it's time. I mean, we are certainly, we've been on top a long time for economic reasons. We are the largest debtor nation in the history of the world, so there are financial reasons for people to look for something else. There are also political reasons, as you aptly point out. You know, all of a sudden, I mean, if Washington gets angry at you, too bad, they cut you off. Or they confiscate your assets. They just take your assets. They say, okay, they're ours now. So as you point out, many people, including our friends, are starting to say, wait a minute, guys. Wait a minute, this is not the way it's supposed to work. If I have an international medium of exchange, I should be able to use it for anything I want anywhere in the world. Well, it's sinking in to many people that there are many reasons to start looking for a competitor, and many major players in the world are looking for a competitor to something to compete with the US dollar. I don't like this, Adam, but I can see it happening, and we all have to adjust to it, whether we like it or not. I don't know. Normally, I would think it would be the Chinese currency, because for many reasons, but the Chinese currency is a blocked currency. I mean, I can go online and buy the euro if I want, or the US dollar. I cannot buy and sell the Chinese currency easily. So that's not a player at the moment anyway. Maybe that will change. So I don't know what it's going to be. If you know, please don't announce it on this program. Please send me a private email so that I can buy some too. I am looking for the new competitor to the US dollar, but it's happening. It's happening before our eyes if you bother to look. And it's going to be, I remember when the pound sterling lost its status as the reserve. You know, in 1920s, Britain was the richest, most powerful country in the world. It was number one. There was no number two. There was no rival in the 20s. 50 years later, 1976 to be precise, Britain was bankrupt. Literally, the IMF had to bail out Great Britain because they were bankrupt. They went from no competitor to total bankruptcy. So it has happened, it can happen, and it will happen to everybody eventually in the big scheme of history. And I don't, as I say, I don't know, by 1776, the dollar was rising strongly. It had a great play after the Second World War. But unfortunately, that play has been going on for a long time. And I say, I don't know what it's going to be. I look for it every day. And if you do know, send me an email.
Okay. If I know, you are definitely in my private email chat before we open it up to the greater world here on Wealthion.
By the way, I do want to just say, because I lived through that whole, when the English lost that status and when they went bankrupt, and it was a nightmare for the English. Many English people immigrate, they left their country because of what was happening. I mean, some people made, I mean, the Beatles didn't leave. The Beatles didn't leave England in the 60s, and they did extremely well. But many, many other people left England in those days because it was such a nightmare.
And, you know, history, you know, they say it rhymes, right? It doesn't always exactly repeat itself, but there's an awful lot of commonality, as you are very good to point out here. I'm asking you to speculate here, but if and when it is the US dollar's time to lose its privilege as the world reserve currency, do you expect that to be more of an event or a process, right? Is it something that happens over years or decades, or is it something that kind of just one morning you wake up and there's a new regime?
Well, it's usually a process. More and more people get affected as more and more measures get taken by the politicians to save you. They always say hurt you always, but it's usually a process. Now, eventually, it's I can remember 1976 when Britain went bankrupt. It was on the evening news everywhere when that happened. But that process had been in train for several years, several decades.
All right. So is it sort of like the old Hemingway quote, how do you go broke gradually and then all at once? It was sort of deteriorating and then bang, it became a crisis.
That's exactly the way it happens to nations, to currencies. Yes.
All right. And I'm asking you to speculate here again, so no one's going to hold you to this. But this time around, would you expect the US dollar to be supplanted by another competing currency, or do you think we might fracture into kind of a multi-currency system for at least some period of time?
Well, the way things are going now, your latter scenario is more likely. I mean, there is the European scenario, there is the Asian scenario, there is the Western Hemisphere. There are varieties of spheres of influence that could be, because I don't see, you know, in the 60s, the 50s and 60s, there was the US dollar because of what happened in the Second World War and after. So it was very clear who was riding up to replace the pound. I don't see that happening now. So I would suspect it's going to be spheres of influence or spheres of currencies, if you want to look at it that way. And eventually one of them will come out on top, either after a war, or after its depression or something. Some kind of historic event will take place, which will somebody will then suddenly rise to the top over the various regions. But again, I don't know. I don't know who or what or when.
Okay. And I don't want to, you know, reveal any of your membership in, you know, private closed door Illuminati, we rule the world groups, but I have had a couple of speakers on this program. I'll mention them by name really quickly. One is Simon Hunt. I'll link to my interview with him here. One is Alistair McLeod. I'll link to my interview with him again here, where they have talked about apparently sort of an Asian bloc, or at least a bloc of countries led by Asia, that is apparently looking to put together a commodities-backed currency, potentially priced in gold grams. I'm just curious, is this anything that you hear about living out there in Asia, or is
you sort of watching? I read the same things you do. You don't have to have closed doors, you know, bars or something. We all know the problems, the political and economic problems of the US dollar. It's not a secret. Everybody knows it, and everybody knows that people are looking. It's being accelerated. I mean, the Ukraine war has accelerated this surge because of what the U.S. did. You know, they just seized assets. They blocked assets of innocent people. They just said, we suspect something's up, and they seized their assets or blocked their assets. So many people, this movement is being accelerated by Washington's actions. I hate to say so. Yes, it just makes, and many people know that gold has been around for centuries. By the way, silver has been much more often used as the backing for currencies throughout history. I mean, Jesus Christ was sold for 30 pieces of silver. Yeah. He wasn't sold for 30 pieces of gold.
Well, and thousands of years before that, you had the Egyptians using it, correct?
You had the what?
I said, but thousands of years before that, you had the Egyptians using it, correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Well, actually, the U.S. currency, when America was founded as a nation, the U.S. dollar was first backed by silver. It was a silver-backed currency in 1792 when we set up the monetary system, et cetera. So the silver has been around for, and more common, China in the 1930s was a silver-based economy, many places have been silver, but it doesn't matter whether it's silver or gold or seashells. You know, people come up with something to back the currency. It makes sense because people, as I've explained before, what are we going to do? And people, they look around, they don't see anything else. So they say, well, why don't we back a currency with something real? Everybody knows what gold is, silver, wheat, whatever it happens to be. So it is a very likely scenario that people will try for a while, especially if we have more and more problems and crises. And eventually, a gold-backed currency has problems too. That's why they always get changed. And the politicians, it's too hard for the politicians. They say, oh my gosh, this is too hard. So they change the rules. They're always changing the rules. So then they will get rid of the gold standard again, or the silver standard, or whatever.
Right. That's because they impose discipline, which many politicians don't like, because they just want to be able to be.
Of course they don't like discipline. What's wrong with you? Are you serious? You know, these guys can't get a real job. That's why they work for the government. They don't want to be disciplined. There was a study not so long ago that showed that the American politicians, when they were kids, they excelled at playground. They were the best kids during recess at playground. So that's why they become successful politicians. They don't know what they're doing, and they want the easy way. So yes, the easy way at one point seemingly may be gold or silver-backed currencies, but eventually that causes discipline, and they change the rules again.
All right. So this is the time in our conversations, Jim, when you're in your home office, where you usually pull out a a gold and a silver coin to show folks on the screen here. Oh, you're going to do it.
Yes.
There we go. All right. Well, look, you are in Asia, and actually there is a gold plated statue behind you there. And I just want to ask you just to opine for a moment here, because most of the viewers of this channel are Westerners. We speak English. They live in most of the English speaking countries. But you spend your time in Asia these days. If you could just talk about the cultural appreciation of precious metals there and just differentiate it versus the average Westerner.
Well, yeah, again, it's historic. As you pointed out, the Egyptians once upon a time, as I pointed out, the Americans once upon a time, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, there for historic reasons, mainly, I mean, India is a gigantic consumer of gold and silver for many reasons, for many decades. The Chinese are becoming more and more gold oriented and more silver oriented. But this, again, it's historic. You go through periods when you get suspicious about your government or suspicious about your currency. They know. I mean, I'm an old peasant, Adam, and all of us old peasants know that when things get bad, we want some gold under the closet, under the bed. We want some silver in the closet. We know. Because we, all of us old peasants, have been around long enough to know what goes wrong. So, and right now in Asia, they see what's happening for whatever reason more vividly than we seem to in the West. And they are not just Asian, but many people are buying more and more gold and silver and putting it under the bed, putting it in the closet, including me.
And that's the main reason why I asked this question. There's a cartoon. I'm going to see if I can find it here and put it up on the screen. But it shows basically, I think it's the U.S. versus China, but it really could be the U.S. versus Asia, where China's throwing big bundles of dollars at the U.S. Across a net, and the U.S. is throwing gold bars back to China. And you can see them stacking up in each country's respective side of the net. And you're thinking, wait a minute, Chinese are actually getting a big pile of gold. The U.S. is just ending up with a bunch of paper. I think the Chinese are getting the better deal out of this. But there's a massive west to east flow of precious metals going on right now, isn't there?
Well, I mean, the numbers are very clear for anybody who wants to look them up and read. Yes, it's happening. Just anecdotally, you know, when I first came to China, even decades ago, it was hard to buy gold in China. Now there are many gold shops, many banks. You can go in and they will sell you gold coins, gold silver coins. I mean, it's very easy now because the demand is obviously there. These shops wouldn't crop up. These banks wouldn't pop up unless there was demand. So yes, I mean, you and I read the same statistic. These are numbers that are easily available. The Indians are buying, a lot of Asians. I mean, yes, Westerners too, but especially Asians who have lived through periods of bad times before.
Right. They have those bad times much more in the forefront of their national memory, where in the U.S. we're so many generations removed from the really hard times now that we just have forgotten a lot of that. Correct. You're nodding as I'm saying this. One question, Jim, is the largest asset in the world, as I understand it, or at least it was until recently, was the Chinese real estate market. You know, the Chinese have been big investors in real estate. A lot of trouble in its real estate market this year. I'm curious, is that uncertainty in their real estate market driving any of these gold purchases where they're sort of shifting from one asset to another?
Well, you'd have to ask the people who are doing it. I don't know, but I would just suspect historically, yes, you know as well as I do that when people are losing a lot of money in a gigantic asset like real estate, they look for something to save themselves. It increases their level of anxiety. And gold and silver have been around for centuries. Yes, it's very clear. There has been a bubble in Chinese property. And by the way, Beijing for a long time has talked about it and tried to do something about it unsuccessfully. Now, whether it's the market or Beijing or who, something is happening and that bubble is popping. And it's good. When all real estate bubbles pop, as you know, it goes on a long time and a lot of people suffer badly.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of Chinese, sadly, will suffer if it continues there just because it was such a massively owned asset class for them, right?
There are 1,400,000,000 Chinese. That's not a typo. 1 billion with a B, 400 million Chinese. It's a huge country. It's the size of the continental 48 states, so it's huge. Yes. And many of them grew up without property after, you know, Beijing started changing its view towards capitalism. Huge numbers of people went into property and real estate.
Wow.
And now there are going to be consequences.
Yeah. Sorry, I just got another Chinese consequence question. I'm trying to limit my questions here, but you keep raising so many great threads. Back to the economy for a moment here. Global economy has been slowing. The last time the global economy like really slowed down, not including the pandemic, but was 2008. And China kind of saved the global economy because it wasn't highly indebted at that point. And it started allowing itself to take on a lot more debt. So it powered a lot of demand through the recovery from the global financial crisis. I don't think it can do that, play that role again. Correct me if you think differently. But what I want to ask you about is here in the immediate term, we've had this short-term rally in the market, this recent rally in the markets. Part of that has been sparked by some recent announcements coming out of China where people are thinking, okay, China's about to come out of lockdown and we're going to get a surge in demand here as a result of that. Given your vantage point where you are, do you think that that's a correct assumption?
Well, I hope so. I've been in quarantine for a long time here in China. But I do sense and see that they're opening up a bit. Yes, yes, yes. And of course, that will help. China's been suffering in the last year or so from the virus and lockdown and the real estate bubble popping, which will badly affect anybody. And it is having an effect in China. And yes, if they open up, but still, when you go from lockdown, total lockdown, to even total openness, it takes a while. People don't suddenly find themselves rich and spending a lot of money, especially if there's a real estate bubble popping. So no, China's not going to disappear. We in America became the most successful country in the 20th century, but my gosh, Adam, we had huge problems along the way. Civil war, many depressions, massacres in the streets. You could buy and sell you could still buy and sell congressmen, but they were cheap in those days. You know, you could buy five or six for the price of one now. No, China will certainly continue to have problems. They will survive. I'm not giving up on China. It's not going to disappear. In 2008, they had a lot of money saved up. The world started collapsing, so they started spending. When it started raining, the Chinese started spending the money. But now China even has a whole lot of debt. I don't see who can save us now. North Korea doesn't have any debt, but they're not big enough to save the world like China was in 2008 when they had staggering amounts of reserves. There's nobody that I can see.
God,
not even the Federal Reserve, not even the central bank in America.
All right, so we're short on saviors here. So I'm going to start to try to land the plane here, Jim, because you've been so gracious and generous with your time here. I'm going to try to connect a couple things you said and correct it any way you like. Global economy is slowing. We are likely on a trajectory to the worst recession of your lifetime. That said, there are cross currents that will be going on here probably the whole time, but cross currents. In other words, while things are slowing, China may come to the rescue in the near term by opening back up and goosing things a little bit. But overall, the trajectory is going to be down. And at some point, we're going to tip into a really bad global recession, likely to be accompanied by a bad bear market, as you've been saying, maybe the worst bear market of your lifetime and therefore our lifetimes as well. Do I have the arc right, or is there anything else you'd put in there?
Well, I just want to add that.
Our interview with Jim will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it, and be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Jim for free, just go to wealthion.com/Adam's Notes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook Jim's detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Jim's mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Jim Rogers. Thank you.